You're listening to a Lewis and Clark podcast. Visit us online at www.lclark.edu.
Lewis and Clark Law Professor Paula Abrams has devoted her career to considering complex legal questions about issues such as equality, reproductive rights, and the tensions between environmental and human rights approaches to population policy. Her latest book, Cross Purposes, looks at a landmark 1922 Supreme Court case that sought to address the fundamental question, do parents have the right to determine how their children should be educated? We sat down with Professor Abrams to talk about her scholarly work, her teaching, and this landmark case. As a scholar of constitutional law, what kinds of questions or issues are you interested in addressing?
Constitutional law is a source of constant fascination for me because it gets to really fundamental questions about how we view ourselves as individuals and as a society. I think that the questions I find most intriguing are questions about why a society decides to protect certain rights as fundamental. What is it about the history, about the cultures, about the values of a society that leads it to say that some interests should be protected from the actions of the majority and protected as fundamental interests? How do those values evolve over time? In my work, I tend to be most interested in rights that are not explicitly written in the Constitution, like parental rights, which is the subject of the Pierce case, and reproductive rights. And so I'm intrigued by what do these particular rights have in common with rights that are explicit in the Constitution, like equality and religion and speech? And how does the Supreme Court go about deciding that certain interests are fundamental, that it's part of what it means to be a free person in a democratic society?
So let's talk a little bit about the case. Uh-huh. Who were the players involved, and what was the context there?
The main characters were probably the state of Oregon and the people of the state of Oregon and the U.S. Supreme Court. There were a lot of other interesting characters, though, along the way, including the Ku Klux Klan, who were heavily involved in pushing this, and the Scottish Rite Masons, who actually put forward the proposal, the Catholic Church, a number of egotistical attorneys, the governor of the state at the time, local and national Bolsheviks. So it was quite a colorful cast of characters. The initiative was challenged by the Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, which was the order that ran most of the Catholic schools in this state. Once the initiative was passed, there was a great deal of discussion about how it would be challenged, right? The sisters and a private, non-religious school, Hill Military Academy, joined together to challenge the law. They wanted both a religious institution and a non-religious institution to be part of the litigation. Right? And they made a number of different challenges to the law, but the main challenge was based on an argument that the law interfered with parental rights, and it violated the rights of parents to control the education and upbringing of their children. All right. So they raised a number of other challenges, including the economic harms to the schools and things like that, because it was clear that this law would have had, it didn't directly shut down the schools, but would have had the effect of shutting down the private schools because it required children to attend public schools for so many hours a day, and that left very little time for children to go to private schools. So the Catholic Church actually came in and directed and paid for the litigation on the part of the sisters. Hill Military Academy received some sponsorship and some funding to also participate in the case. The state argued that the law was a legitimate regulation that furthered the state's interest in assimilating its children, right, and assuring that children had a common education. And the state argued that there were concerns about radicalism, and there were threats to the country in terms of radicalists, and they argued that compulsory public education provided assimilation and in many ways promoted the security of the country, that only through compulsory public education could the state be sure that students were getting an education in democracy and that they were learning patriotism. Again, you put this in the context of the post-World War I and the kind of fear of Bolshevism and radicalism that was pervasive all throughout the country. Just pick up the headlines. There are headlines everywhere talking about the radical threats. And so that was the argument that the state made, that it was a permissible means of assimilating children and protecting the security of the country. And when it got to the Supreme Court said essentially, these are valid interests that the state has, but the means used, shutting down all private schools, are not an acceptable means because it interferes with the rights of parents. And parents have this long understood right to raise their children as they see fit. And what the court said in a portion of the opinion that tends to be the most quoted is that the state doesn't have the authority to standardize its children by forcing them to attend public schools and basically kind of assuring this same kind of cookie-cutter patriotism that the state had argued.
And so you'd mentioned the relevance or the importance of historical and political contexts, and I was wondering if you think there's something unique about Oregon that the case should have grown out of this state as opposed to another?
The case says, I think, something both about Oregon and about the country, the nation at the time that the initiative was passed. But compulsory public education, which is what this would have required, was not just a local issue. It was on the national agenda of the Ku Klux Klan, of the Scottish Rite Masons, and even of a number of educational progressives who saw the public schools as a great melting pot and a great equalizer, that all children would receive the same education, that elitist private institutions would disappear, and immigrant children would be assimilated, and everyone would get kind of a democratic education, as they liked to describe it at the time. All right. Now, this context is also, you have to think this is after World War I. Anti-immigrant sentiments are very high. Anti-communist sentiments are very high. There's a lot of hysteria around the country about immigrant forces and new people coming to this country and what that would mean for this country. In Oregon, we're dealing with a state that suffered a significant economic and social upheaval following World War I. Economic times were difficult here, as they were in many places. It was a state that was beginning to see change and beginning to see some level of immigration, but enough to make people, I think, concerned about what was their future going to be, what was going to happen to the state. And so the economics, the fear of radicalism, all that, I think, came into play in Oregon, as it did in other states around the country also. Oregonians also were pioneers in using the initiative as a vehicle of social change. And so if we think of the first couple decades of the 20th century, Oregon stood out among all the states, really in the country, in using the initiative to bring about enhanced rights for women, limiting the power of government. It was very enamored of the initiative process, as we still are in many ways. Mm-hmm. And this measure, I think, appealed to people because it was an initiative that offered control of the school system to the people of Oregon in a way that they hadn't had control before.
And so what does the title Cross Purposes speak to?
There were a lot of strange bedfellows in the course of this initiative process because you did have not only the Klan and the Masons involved, but you had individuals who and believed strongly in public education as a great equalizer in this country, and that it was the best thing for children, and that it furthered the cause of equality in this country. So you had bigots joining with educational progressives for very different purposes, and they all saw very different things in this measure. And so I think it speaks a little bit to that also.
It's interesting that when you look throughout history, a government's response to the people during times of war, after war, what comes out of that, that we seem to be doomed to repeat ourselves in that regard.
No, I think that's a really important point, and I think that's one of the reasons that the book is timeless in this sense, and the story is timeless in this sense, because we do seem to have these periodic episodes in our country where there are concerns about radical influences and how they are going to affect our society and our democracy. And the question then becomes, well, what can you do about it? What can the state do about it? What can the government do about it? What should the government do about it? And these are significant questions, and not unlike some of the questions that are being raised today, obviously, in the context of how much do immigrants bear some hostility when times are difficult, when economics are difficult or political situations are difficult. Public sentiment can often turn against immigrants or against people that seem different. And so this story asks those questions. How far can the state go in the interests of assimilating people and in the interest of what it sees as its security interests? In 1922, it was protecting, you know, the country from the threat of Bolshevism, that, you know, that the revolution in Russia would come to these shores and would take over this country. That was a palpable concern. And so the players change, but the fundamental issues don't necessarily change that much. And so we see ourselves asking some of the same questions. And when I did the research on this book, I saw some remarkable similarities in terms of the arguments that the government was making, the type of argument that the government made to justify regulation, and that it's all these kind of fear and loathing type arguments. And those arguments haven't gone away.
So do you see any trends or any ripple effects from that case still relevant today?
There are many. I mean, this is a landmark case, and when you have a landmark case, there are bound to be ripple effects. This case became known by many parents as the Magna Carta of education, because it gave parents what they thought was a precedent to allow them to become have more say in the education process of their children. And this precedent has been influential, I think, in the homeschooling movement. It's been influential in school vouchers, the court's decision on school vouchers, even though that was decided on Establishment Clause grounds. The issue of parental rights comes up in many contexts, both in the education system and obviously outside the education system. So it's certainly its effect in the education arena and any issues where parental rights are central. It's also had its effect, as I mentioned earlier, in the context of the Supreme Court's consideration of rights that aren't explicitly written in the text of the Constitution. This provides precedent for some of the other more controversial cases that have come later, such as cases dealing with contraception and abortion and sexual intimacy.